If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at TNTradio.live. When the whole world seems turned upside down, we sort through it together. Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to Weekends. Thanks for your company today. And if you get a chance, please share any of the videos that you like on your social media, because the more we brand, the more that we get the information out there, the more it's tested in the mainstream, the more we get to take down said mainstream news and present the real, unbiased, actual facts, no vested interests, news to twist the narrative back towards reality. And that's what we're going to attempt to do in this hour as we deal with what many Sydneysiders are asking: is this just a tragedy, a double tragedy that happened last weekend, or is there something more to feather yet another agenda? What is it going to be? So, around about this time last week on this show, we shared the news as it was breaking of the attacks at Bondi Junction, Westfield, in the eastern suburbs of Sydney. We've now since worked out or learnt that Joel Couchy, aged 40, was the attacker who was shot and killed by a female police officer in the Westfield, but not before he took the lives of six people and injured 18 more. It certainly shocked Sydney. Many people can't believe what's actually going on in a country that had its guns taken away after the Port Arthur incident almost 30 years ago. So how can this happen? How can it be so lethal? And how can we possibly work out if it is the government using this against the people once again? One of the things that bothered me was when Anthony Albanese came out and said that men must work out that they are too violent and therefore men have got the problem. For which women were sharing on Twitter, hang on a second, what about Bollard Man, the man that tried to stop the attacker? These generalizations and oversimplifications just will not cut it, and it stinks to high heaven of yet another agenda. How much more can men be demasculated? How much more masculinity can you take away before you realize that men have been weakened to a point where they're not even recognizable anymore, certainly not from their fathers in just a generation, right? So with that, and of course what we saw on Monday with Bishop Marmari Emmanuel being attacked by a 16-year-old boy on a live stream in his church, and then you realize that two knife attacks in 3 days, well, was this a coincidence? Was it simply bad luck? Or is it a perfect storm that you can start getting action taken, or yet again, authority to demand more rules for it against us and our freedoms once again being taken away? So in this hour, I've got not one but two former policemen who are going to join me for a frank discussion about what they saw, what they think, and hopefully we'll be able to put together what we can look for and how the system actually works. Let me tell you what's going on. So, Steve Kelly is currently working as a solicitor at AFL Solicitors with Tony Nikolic, which is based in Sydney at Barangaroo and also at Guildford now. Prior to that, he was in the New South Wales Police for 28 years before being forced to resign due to the vaccine mandates in 2021. He'd spent 20 of those years in Police Prosecutions Command. He's worked in local court, children's court, and coroner's court. When he left the New South Wales Police, he put out a video about his concerns surrounding the COVID-19 vaccines and how he was forced to resign. This potentially could be classified as misinformation today, even though a lot of what he said was back in 2021 has come true. And Harry Hatzikalymnios is a former detective, senior constable, the Australian Federal Police, with over 20 years' experience. Harry has been speaking out against the COVID restrictions since the beginning and is well-versed in how the system really operates. Let me bring in Steve Kelly right now. Steve, thanks for your time today and welcome to Weekends for the first time.
Oh, thanks, Jason. It's good to be here, actually. I'm normally on Rick Munn, so it's good to get an invite onto your show too.
Well, no, that's terrific. And I know Rick's on during the week and a little bit later in the evening for our Australian viewers. And it's obviously morning over there in the UK. And he's such a brilliant, animated, incredible analyst of what's going on. So I'll do my best to keep up with what Rick does. But this is something for all of us Sydney-siders, especially today, who were shocked, disturbed and upset by what we saw. Many of us had known someone who was a victim or stabbed in the attack, or knew people who were there at the day. And so it's devastating when something like that happens. There's a lot that I want to touch on here. And part of it, I guess the best way to start, Steve, is from a former policeman's perspective. What was your reaction when you saw what was playing out in real time?
Well, I've got to say, Jason, I was quite shocked when I first heard the news that this had happened. Although I anticipated that something like this could have happened a couple of years ago when I left the police, that was part of our training within the last 5 years, was the whole active armed offender training that they took on after the Lint cafe siege and the unfortunate deaths there, that the police brought in that sort of training. So, I mean, fortunately, up until last Saturday, nothing like that has really happened again since the Lint cafe incident. But, yeah, no, I was completely shocked that something like that had happened, particularly in Sydney. And it's unfortunately a sign of the times across the world.
As a former police officer, Steve, when something like that happens, is there an adrenaline rush that sort of says, you know what, I feel like I need to put my gear on and get down there and help? Or is it something that you sort of say, I'm glad it's not me, but I know that my other colleagues are well-trained in this. Let's just, put a prayer or hope or something and just let them do their job. How do you cope with this in that adrenaline rush?
Well, I think it's something, I suppose, that's for me. I mean, fortunately, I've never had to be called to a situation like that. But I could imagine that police getting a call like that, certainly there would be a lot of adrenaline going on at the time. I'd hate to think what was going through the mind of Inspector Amy Scott at the time that she received the news. And obviously, you know, to her credit, she acts very calmly and professionally in the circumstances, you know, and it would have been extremely difficult for her going in there at the time, being one out and not really knowing the full details of the situation, whether there was one offender or whether there was multiple offenders. So I think, it's something that is a reality, and it's difficult, I suppose, to describe until you're actually in that situation. But I think, most police would go into a particular mindset that they've got to get the job done and go in there and protect people, and that's what she did.
Now, just on that, because you're thinking as this is happening in real time, that you would just allow your training to kick in. It's almost, I can imagine going through it, talking to yourself, watching what's going on. There's so many routines, rituals, et cetera, that you would have to do practices. So is it almost a case of extreme alertness and autopilot in that situation?
I think that the police training obviously kicks in at that point. I mean, police get, training on dealing with these sort of incidents, but certainly not to the extent that, the more specialist commands like the tactical response group and whatnot that are specifically trained for dealing with those sort of occasions where you've got shooters, going into a large public space and committing, mass murder. But certainly there's enough training that we get to prepare us to go in and face, what needs to be done and to protect life. So, I suppose the one, I'm not saying a positive thing, but certainly the situation could have been far worse, particularly for the police responding also if this person had a firearm. So, the death toll could have been a lot higher.
It's savage, isn't it, when you think 18 people injured, 6 deaths. I mean, they're staggering numbers to think with what seemingly was one knife, one man, and nobody able to get up behind him in a situation and, you know, clock him on their head with a bollard or something like that in the moment, the absolute fear, people running for their lives. Have you taken the time to consider perhaps the motivation of this character, Cauchy, and do you go through that as a process, as a routine, as somebody with police training, or again, do you wait to see what reports would come through first? How does that play out in your head?
Well, I think it's probably, now it's probably difficult to work out, particularly at the time, what his motivation may have been for why he did what he did. And obviously that's something that's going to obviously come to light, hopefully in time with the coronial investigation that's going on now. But, one of the things obviously people would have been thinking at the time, whether it was, you know, a terrorism-related incident or politically motivated. But from the reports that they seem to know about this Cauchy at the moment, seems to be that he was a person that had mental health issues, and it doesn't seem to be related to any sort of political ideology. So I'm sure more information will come to light, but at this point, it doesn't appear that that was the reason behind the attack. But no one's really going to know for sure, because obviously he's dead. And that's the role of the investigators to now go back and meticulously try and work out what he was doing and reading and accessing in the last months of his life.
Now, we noticed that the first victims' names that were announced was the young mother who was holding her daughter, and it was absolutely shocking. Then we learned a little bit later of Dawn Singleton, a beautiful 25-year-old lady, and it continued. There was another woman and another woman, etc. And again, this odd motivation about this character, Cauchy. Then we learned that Cauchy was reaching out on social media, trying to make friends to go surfing and other things. Then we learned that he had advertised as a male escort. And then another article popped up during the week that he'd actually approached a particular agency to start work there. And this particular owner of this business was talking to the newspaper and explained that by the look of this character, he wasn't going to get much business, only if he, this is to quote her, if he did gay or turned gay or something. And so therefore he then asked if there would be women coming in, et cetera. And she realized that this man was just after again, connection or sex with women in that scenario. And so you can't help but try and piece all this together and think, was this a lonely man who took out vengeance against women for seemingly perhaps being rejected or something like that? I know that there's a lot of speculation in all of this, but this has got to be what investigators do, is investigate all leads. So have those facts come to light that you've seen? Does this sort of point police into a certain direction where they will investigate for the motive?
Well, I presume, Jason, that that all these things that you've mentioned will be obviously looked at and put together in a brief of evidence for the coroner, and obviously that'll be one of the roles of the coroner to determine the manner and cause of the death and be looking at what was operating on the mind of this person leading up to the events of last Saturday, and to see whether or not there's anything that can be, drawn from these facts that we know now to sort of make any sense of what happened. But from all the bits and pieces that we've heard, I don't think there's anything specifically clear to me as to what's led to what he did.
Absolutely. Well, we've got Harry Hatzikalymnios joining us now. I'm just going to bring Harry in. For those that don't know, Harry is a former detective senior constable at the AFP with over 20 years' experience. Harry, welcome to Weekends.
Yeah, hi, Jason. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, good to see you, Harry. It's great to have you on the show, and thanks for joining us on a special panel today, examining what we've seen with the particular events of last Saturday at Bondi, and of course the events with Bishop Marmari Emmanuel on Monday, where he too was stabbed. I've asked Steve a number of introductory questions, and I just wanted to perhaps get your reaction to what you saw firstly on Saturday, as it relates to your previous experience. Were you as shocked perhaps as Steve was, or did you think that this was something that was inevitable perhaps?
I wasn't shocked. Nothing really surprises me these days after what we've seen the last 4 years, but I've got a bit of an insight because I live in the area and I do frequent that shopping centre. But I know there's quite, always a lot of security around, and they've got two-way communications, and you know there's what, 7 minutes. So I've just got some questions as to the response time, what was actually going on while this individual was running around, because every time I'm there, there's always security there up and down and around, and it's quite busy. There's times where it's quieter than the normal, but obviously start of the school holidays and Saturday afternoon would be quite a busy time. Yeah, so like I said, nothing really shocks me or surprises me anymore. And then we've got what happened to the bishop. Yeah, and then we had an incident down at a shopping centre. It might have been gang related, I believe, in Melbourne. And then I don't know. I saw something where something happened in Brisbane. I think it was a shopping centre, potentially a shooting. I haven't seen anything further. So things have seemed to have sort of gone off the rails a little bit when it comes to this sort of violence in public places, as you know, where it's normally there's a motive, or there's a gang related, or child youth crime. Yeah, so it's interesting the way things. And then we've got there's a information going around about that memo by the owner of Westfield to shopkeepers what to do, and that's a few days before, should there be such an event happen, which is sort of interesting as well.
Yeah, isn't that interesting that people are on social media replacing this particular memo given out at Westfield at their Pitt Street Mall shopping complex, which is really only 15 minutes away from Bondi Junction, and some saying, well, hang on, how could you have this pre-war knowledge? Did the retailers at Bondi Junction get the same memo? It's an awfully perhaps inconvenient document if you're trying to pretend that nothing was untoward here, but how could you have this forewarned knowledge, and yet this still goes ahead? And there are, of course, questions that we'll ask after the break a bit more in detail. But until then, we're going to take that first break now. And if you love a good documentary, then you'll love our special screenings Uninterrupted. Cinema features some of the latest or notable documentaries from the world's best filmmakers. You can check out TNT's website for more information. Weekends are better when you spend it with us on today's News Talk, TNT.
TNT. Sonia Paulton.
If the British courts take the USA's poor application seriously and extradite Julian Assange, they will almost certainly have blood on their hands. Those are my words, not Stella's, although I know she thinks the same. She said so. The court has refused to address the very credible evidence that the CIA planned to kidnap and assassinate Julian Assange. We should all remember this moment the next time the UK or the USA dare to claim we are a free society while lecturing other countries about their lack of press freedoms. Julian Assange has been denied his freedom for 15 years. The entire process has been his punishment.
Sonia Paulton on today's News Talk, TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's News Talk, TNT Radio, should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
Are you sitting comfortably?
Oh, yes, yes.
Then I'll begin.
Even when you're just sitting around, we're rocking the talk.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Weekends. My guest this hour, Steve Kelly and Harry Hatzikalymnios. It was about this time last week, almost to the minute, when we first got news of what happened at Bondi at Westfield, where attacker Joel Couchy murdered 6 people and injured 18 more. Harry, first question after the break to you. How come, if Waverley Police Station was less than a kilometre away, did it take so long for police to arrive at Westfield? Why does this happen in such a situation?
Yeah, that's a question I've been pondering and asking myself. When we heard it was 7 minutes till someone got there, then they were alone. Yeah, so I suppose I think when this investigation or the coronial inquiry, whatever happens, we need answers to that question specifically. I think you'd probably run there in about 4 minutes. So yeah, on foot, it's not that far. I know the area very well. Yeah, so that's, and then there was only one officer. And obviously we'll never know what was in the mind of the individual that did those horrendous things. But yeah, that is a question that we will definitely need answering as to why it took so long and where were the other, there's more than 2 security officers. I don't know how many there were, but I would have thought it's quite a big complex. So there would have been more than just 2 security officers working that day in Westfield, and they've got those little earpieces with communication, so the word would have got out. I would have thought they would have been there a lot quicker than the 7 minutes to lend support possibly.
Now, Steve, when you consider that you've got security officers running around, do they have the ability to get involved in any way, or are they really just going to separate the attacker from the shoppers and just sort of create space and wait for police to arrive?
Well, I suppose, it's difficult for security guards because, their level of training is different to police, and more often than not, they don't have any sort of weapons to defend themselves, the majority. I mean, they can make a citizen's arrest, but certainly it seems to me that that'd be one thing that the coroner's going to be looking at, is whether or not security guards in these major shopping centres need to have more additional resources to deal with an incident like that, because they're going to be the first responders before the police get there. So, whether or not they should have firearms will be something that will be obviously looked at. But certainly getting back to the point that was raised before about the delay too, one of the things, I think the New South Wales Police Force is pretty under-resourced at the moment too. So that's potentially a significant area that should be addressed as well as to why it's under-resourced. I think we know why it's under-resourced, and we know that many good police have lost their jobs in the last couple of years. And so I think that, that's certainly an important issue too that needs to be considered in looking at, all these major incidents that are happening in our society today. And I know we're talking about this particular incident, but there's, problems in regional New South Wales too with crime out of control. So, we're looking at broader issues, obviously, but certainly... In relation specifically to the question of the delay and the police taking 7 minutes to get there, it may have been that that they had cars in other parts of the command which weren't within that 1 kilometre radius of the police station. But obviously, I'm not in a position to say what resources they had at the time and as to whether their response was satisfactory or not in terms of getting there as soon as they could.
Now, a question for both gentlemen, Harry and Steve. Should security guards carry weapons? For example, do they carry a taser? Would a taser in this situation have been of any benefit? Harry?
Well, yeah, give them something. Look, there could be a case, and that's up to the coroner, that maybe they should carry a baton, extendable baton, pepper spray, and a taser. I mean, if they had access to a baton, maybe that poor, it was like the first day on the job, that security officer, and what level of training do they have? So we've got to look into that as well. It's not just a PR. If they're just putting him on purely for a PR, and just for them to be there as to appear that there's some level of safety and some surveillance there. I mean, they've got cameras all around as well, but I think they need to be trained, and they need to be trained correctly. And also, I mean, a baton's as long, probably longer than a 12-inch knife. So definitely a baton, I think, would have come in handy with the right training to disarm the individual, you know, hip to the knee, and it's all over. Pepper spray and tasers don't always connect and don't always work. So, yeah, so definitely I would think a baton and pepper spray would be two good things to possibly look at. And as far as firearm goes, that's, lethal force. That's pretty, something that shouldn't be taken in and should be considered very carefully. So maybe those two. And then by that time it gives them something. Then by the time hopefully police arrive and they can take control of the situation and assess what needs to be done.
It's obviously a very delicate argument, and I've had security guards tell me that under no circumstances should a security guard be given any form of weapon, claiming ego, attitude, lack of training, etc. But at the end of the day, six people lost their lives in what should have been preventable, or at least less people should have lost their lives. Steve, have you formed an opinion on whether security guards should be carrying some form of weapon?
Well, I think that I agree with everything Harry's said in relation to that. I mean, I know some security guards carry firearms in relation to, those that are transporting money, from banks and whatnot. But obviously, if security guards are going to carry firearms, they certainly need to have the same, they'd have to pass the same requirements and go through the same tests that police do and anyone that gets a firearms license. But I think at a bare minimum, I certainly think a baton and pepper spray, and also, there may be a need also for tasers. But, tasers don't always, in a situation with someone that's got a large knife, taser may not always pay off too. But certainly I think that the issue of security guards being armed has to be a question that needs to be looked at.
I understand it's a challenge and it's a delicate situation, and I think that a lot more discussion and debate. I guess one way of proposing another perspective on this was that if either of you were to be offered a job, let's say as head of security at a Westfield shopping centre, and because of your police experience, would you therefore argue for the point that you should be carrying said weapons? Steve?
Well, I think in the situation, yes, I would. But obviously, I'd be making sure that before those weapons are given to the security guards, that they are adequately trained with the knowledge about when it's appropriate and not appropriate to use them. Because I think certainly the concern would be about some people may abuse the power and use them in situations where it's not appropriate. But again, as long as there's appropriate checks and balances, that any use of any particular weapon is reviewed and that they're accountable, obviously, then I think that it wouldn't be a something that I would be against, particularly in light of what happened last Saturday. And if it can prevent one person's death, then I think it's got to be a positive thing.
Now, Harry, there are many police officers, as Steve just told us, who, because of the shortage in the police force due to mandates, etc., if you were offered $200,000 a year to be the head of security at Westfield, would you expect or argue for being able to carry weapons as such? Not necessarily for all of the security team, but somebody with the appropriate training. Do you think that's a valid argument?
Yeah, look, I think it's a valid argument. And what I would do is I would obviously get there and have a look at what their operating procedures are and make sure that there's a manual, and then what I'll be pushing for is for extensive training for the security in unarmed combat, and I'd be pushing for baton and probably pepper spray at a minimum. And obviously, yeah, we need checks and balances, but they're all licensed. You get a security license, criminal background check, and Yeah, and there's consequences, as there is for police, that are to step the mark and use excessive force or don't follow the law or the values that they're supposed to. So no, I would be definitely, because I think, you know, prevention is, you know, had we had this in place, we may well have been in a position where last Saturday's transpired may have been prevented, or may not have been as, you know, the outcome may not have been as bad as what it was. So definitely, I think if you're going to be in that business of security, I mean, you've also got people that are bodyguards or personal protection that carry firearms, so they get extensive training. So if you're going to do the job, you need to be trained, and you need to be trained well. And there's also a duty of care on the employer under the OHS, occupational health and safety, that if you're putting someone in a position like that, they need to be, yeah, I think, you know, we need to possibly examine, like, these shopping centres, if they're hiring staff, are they hiring under the right circumstances and making sure that they're fully trained and equipped to do the job, whether they're carrying anything or not? Or is it just a token thing where they've got security to walk around and appear that there's some surveillance and some safety there? So there's also, I think, a great onus on the employer under OHS to make sure that the people they're employing are actually trained and the training is adequate for what they may encounter.
Now, for the most part, you would consider, just like an armed guard transferring cash and coins in an armored truck carries a weapon, it's seen as a deterrent more than anything else. So if it was to become known that major shopping centres now had armed guards that were former or retired police officers as head of security, it's not that far of a reach. I'm reminded of many years ago when media mogul Kerry Packer had a heart attack on the field playing polo, that as a gesture back to the state, he donated defibrillators to ambulances at the cost at the time of around $3 million from memory. In the tragedy of Dawn Singleton's loss and John Singleton, one of Australia's most well-known and wealthiest men, I can't imagine the pain that goes through that man's heart and through his family at this stage, with all that money and all those resources, can do absolutely nothing to bring back his darling Dawnie. And I wonder, therefore, if one of the legacies that John might consider is how then that we can do something to protect others so that this never happens again. And I juxtapose that against the idea of police, authority, government jumping up and down and telling us all about technology's going to save us. This time, people are talking about facial recognition, they're talking about digital identity, and of course, leading up to the idea that more surveillance across the board. So given that scenario, I'm just wondering, Steve, are there any scenarios here that you can consider that the police will ask for such technological powers in lieu of what we've talked about here as a potential solution, which is just another way to take the freedoms off the 99.99% repeater who are innocent people just trying to get on with their lives? Why should they have to pay in such a way?
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose at this stage, I don't know, Jason, really what the police are going to propose, but certainly if, I mean, I like you, would be concerned about any attempt to try and bring in a system or surveillance, extra surveillance that will lead to having a draconian response in relation to, taking away our civil liberties, and that all this facial recognition technology is placed in shopping centres, and that we're all having to be identified before we walk in. I think, to my mind, I think that would be an extreme reaction. I mean, let's bear in mind also too that this is not something, fortunately, that happens regularly in Australia, and certainly I would be against, you know, any digital technology that's going to be or has the potential to be abused by government for its own ends to bring in greater control of us and take away our liberties, because, as you say, 99% of the population are law-abiding citizens, and I just sort of think that anything that is brought in, and I'm not saying that I'm against bringing in safety measures or extra security to prevent a similar incident from happening again. But it's all got to be balanced against what the end goal is, and you know, the means that they're going to use to try and implement that. But at this stage, you know, I'm only speculating as to you know, whether or not such technology is going to be a recommendation down the track.
Now, Harry, have you got an opinion on what might be requested as going forward from here? We know that the government never lets a crisis get in the way of making changes for its benefit. What's your thoughts?
Look, my thoughts are we've already got, you know, we've got cameras in the junction, we've got cameras in the shopping centre. You know, there were security guards there, and it still didn't prevent what transpired on Saturday. So I don't think the answer is not more surveillance. I think we need to go back to the drawing board and look where society's at. How do we get here? And I don't know, maybe people don't want to get involved because they're worried about if they do something, they may get charged. You know, someone breaks into your home, you're worried, you could defend yourself all of a sudden, you're on the back of an assault charge. You know, so that may have something to do with it. But the reality is police, doesn't matter what you do, police cannot be there. They can't be everywhere. So I don't know whether we go back to what we used to years ago. Everyone gets, when they're young, they get training in self-defense or whatever. And it, you know, through, we've got the army reserves or cadets and things like that where people are instilled, you know, moral values and, you know, and we go that way. But I think that's what's been lost. And what we're seeing now is we've seen decades and decades of societal change and social engineering. And we're seeing now the, you know, the results of what's been allowed to happen by successive governments and bureaucrats and, you know, the medical establishment, you know, and that's where we're at. And it's manifesting in all areas. And we just got to look what they're teaching or what they're not teaching children at school. They're teaching everything else. But so, yeah, I definitely think more surveillance is, you know, you give up your liberties, you know, for security, you'll end up with neither, the famous quote. So, no, I mean, it's individual responsibility. And we saw the French guy with the bollard. I mean, I would have liked him to actually go down and knock him over with that bollard. I mean, you know, the bollard was much bigger than the knife, but, you know, obviously it's a stressful situation. Everyone reacts differently, but good on him for what he's doing. But we need more of that, I think. We need more men to step up and not think in the back, and what if I do this? And that's, you see that all the time. Things are happening and people just don't get involved. And then someone does something, whatever, and they call him a hero. No, that's what, you know, that's called just, you know, humanity, but caring for your fellow male or female. You know, if something's happening and they're in trouble, you're out there to help and try and you try and disengage, you try and bring it down. If not, well, you step in and you do something until the police arrive, you know, and do a citizen's arrest, whatever you've got to do. But unfortunately, a lot of people haven't got the training because we're not, you know, funny, we're not taught the Constitution at school. It's 33 pages. So we're not taught our rights, and that's the problem. People have lacked the knowledge and understanding of, you know, they're always waiting to be told what they can and can't do. And I think we've got to get away from that. We've got to empower individuals and understand who they are, what they can do and what they can't do. And if someone's in trouble, if a relative of someone's in trouble, you go out and you help. You don't just walk away. You step in and you try and assist. And people, I think we've got to go back to that. Not more surveillance, not more, you know, more cameras. And so what, we would have got them, we would have ID'd them, but would it have made any difference? You know, we've identified, we know, and you know, it, still nothing would have changed, I don't think.
No, absolutely. Now we need to take a quick break. We're going to do that right now. We're going to come back, talk about Bishop Marmari Emmanuel, who was also stabbed on Monday. We'll do that and we'll come straight back. You're watching and listening to Weekends here on TNT.
I said, could she die? And the doctor said she could. It was so scary.
When I started clawing at my neck and trying to breathe, and I thought, you know, what are we going to do if I die here? How's everyone going to go on?
When someone's gravely sick or injured in the bush, they rely on the Royal Flying Doctor Service. But now the Flying Doctor needs your help to fund vital medical equipment and supplies. please search Flying Doctor online to give a regular gift of just $10. You can help equip the Flying Doctor's teams to respond to any emergency anywhere. Search Flying Doctor online. Become a part of the Royal Flying Doctor Service and help save lives in the bush.
Most people are unaware that bad bacteria can grow quickly in food that's stored, prepped, or cooked incorrectly, and that can lead to food poisoning. To avoid bad bacteria, always make sure your hands and cooking utensils are clean. Keep raw meat and chicken away from food that won't be cooked. Run your fridge at or below 5 degrees Celsius and use a meat thermometer to ensure your meat's being cooked to at least 75 degrees Celsius. For more tips on keeping bad bacteria at bay, visit foodsafety.asn.au.
Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to Weekends. My guests this hour, Steve Kelly and Harry Hatzikalymnios, both gentlemen, former police officers in their own divisions, and they're both here today to discuss the attacks in Sydney last week, both on Saturday at Bondi Junction Westfield and Monday at the church in Wakeley regarding Bishop Mari Emanuel and others. Now, in light of what we saw from the Police Commissioner, Karen Webb, she said, police will be the source of truth and not social media and misinformation. I bring that up in line with, first of all, doesn't the police have an internal affairs department? So they're not perfect. But Channel 7 got in big trouble this week for confirming the name of the wrong person as the killer. And that relates back to, again, facial recognition. How accurate would it be? It seems it's the wrong thing. But how can you get a 20-year-old Jewish boy mixed up with Joel Couchy, 40, and name the wrong person like that, Steve?
Yeah, it seems quite amazing that that happened. But I'm not 100% certain of the facts of that particular matter, apart from what you've just told me just momentarily ago about that. But certainly it goes to show that the media make mistakes, and as long as they admit that they've made mistakes, I think that's an important thing. But I don't believe that that it was intentional. But look, at the end of the day, obviously that's something that will be worked out with, the person involved and the Channel 7 in relation to that.
Now, Harry, the misinformation laws propose exclude mainstream media. Typically it's aimed at social media and independent journalists. How then can we be confident, therefore, that we're not going to have the wool pulled over our eyes if this is where we're going? Karen Webb suggesting or telling us that the police are in charge and that's it, and the mainstream news that they rely upon getting the facts wrong. Is this going to hold water, do you think?
Well, I think government and the media have got a problem. The last 4 years during the COVID issue that we had, a lot of the information and that they were coming up with and saying was, that was around on social media, whatever that they were saying was false and was misinformation, has actually ended up being true. So unfortunately, it looks like the biggest perpetrators of propaganda and misinformation is the government and the pharmaceutical industry. So, I've got no confidence, and we know that the media was paid hundreds of millions of dollars, and it's to keep pushing we saw it on the TV every day about, during COVID, about we had the daily briefings everywhere and everyone was sitting there and they were just pushing it one thing after the other, and they got paid. Same thing happened in the UK and in America. So we unfortunately, our media cannot be relied, the media and cannot be relied on telling us the truth or the facts, because unfortunately it appears, especially through what we saw in COVID, that was very tied to the hip with the government, and they let the people down. There's no investigative journalism, and it's still going on today. They're still pushing, even though we've got all this information, all this evidence that there's issues with these shots. They're still not reporting it. It's the odd one here or there, whatever, but that's it. But there's no importance being laid on it. It's everything else. But, you know, the other day it was, I think, something going to the beach gave you a heart attack or whatever, you know, so being in the sun for too long. So look, we can't really rely on the mainstream media. And the problem is we've got this e-safety commission. We've got someone that's not even Australian that's come here. They've just been over at Davos at the World Economic Forum. They've spent $40,000 taxpayer money with a staff member why they couldn't do it by Zoom. And there's video over there saying, we've got to, the freedom of speech, we've got to calibrate freedom of speech, whatever that means. So it's very, very, yeah, she's talking about it openly over at Davos. So, yeah, we're just going to be very careful. And, thank God we've got TNT and we've got other social media agencies that have come out, independent media, which are media, that are actually trying to tell the truth. And they're being attacked and some are being prosecuted and they're having a lot of resources thrown at them by government. And apart from Twitter, which is somewhat, or X now, which is somewhat freer, we've still got Facebook and the other ones actually still shadow banning and not allowing posts to go through. And we saw that with what was live streamed with the bishop, and that's all been taken down. I don't know. Everyone saw that. Everyone knows about it. Why can't we see it? You know, like, that just doesn't make sense. There's no problem with ISIS beheading people. That's all over social media. You know, that's violence. I mean, yeah, the whole thing just doesn't add up. And what the media doesn't realize, the mainstream media, that they've lost credibility apart from the 30 or whatever percent that still listen and watch them. They've lost credibility and, you know, and they're not helping themselves, in trying to get that back. And so have governments. And so have a lot of the bureaucrats at the top. What we're seeing is whether it's by incompetence, malfeasance, or worse, we've got a crisis of leadership in all areas of society at the moment, and that's what's manifesting.
Now, we learnt that a 16-year-old boy has been charged in relation to the stabbing of Bishop Marmari Emmanuel. He's been charged with an act of terrorism. This boy was, as I said, was 16 years of age. He was known to police. He was known, or was reported in The Guardian, that he was known to be acting up at school. My question is it just one charge of an act of terrorism? And should he also be charged, for example, with attempted murder? It seems that these would be very different charges to be able to prove. How is this analysed and how do they arrive at such a charge, Steve?
Look, Jason, I'm not able to give you a definitive answer on that. I mean, obviously it's before the courts at the moment, but obviously based on what the media's reported thus far, I mean, he has been charged. I'm not aware as to the specific nature of the charge that he was charged with, but obviously I'm sure that the police have always got the opportunity to upgrade charges at any point, and obviously the matter will go before, I presume, the DPP. So, and they will vet whatever the police have laid against this child. But certainly, in situations, it's not uncommon for someone to be charged initially with a specific offence, and those charges could either be withdrawn or supplemented by other charges later on down the track.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Harry, 16 years old, known to police. Joel Couchy, 40 years old, known to police. Is this a regular thing in terms of people being known to police, or is this just an added fact that just makes the general public feel like the police aren't doing their job?
Yeah, look, I think we just need a full, once, full investigation and full, we need to know the full facts. Were they known? How were they known? And what did or didn't, weren't they doing about it? I don't know. I mean, the attack on the bishop was actually an assault, depending how badly he was injured. You know, I would have thought it was grievous bodily harm or, maybe attempted murder because he had the knife. The blade didn't eject. I'd be interested to know where the terrorism comes in, they've charged him with terrorism, that would indicate that obviously he's come to, what was the terrorism that's involved? Because this is just a straight out assault on an individual. So yeah, that's, I'm just curious to see. Yeah. And like Steve said, there's plenty of opportunity for them to either upgrade or remove and lay fresh charges. But I'll be very curious to see what the terrorism, where that comes from and how they arrived at that specific charge.
Now, something completely different. A little while ago on this show, I interviewed Daily Telegraph crime reporter Mark Morrie. And the reason I did that, Mark was knew Roger Rogerson quite well and explained over a long career this kind of journalist relationship with this police officer. Now, it's just an opportune time to ask you the question, but characters such as Rogerson, can they still exist in the modern police force, or is this thankfully the end of a bygone era, Steve?
Well, I think characters such as Roger Rogerson, are of a bygone era, but I still think that police can still do the wrong thing and act unlawfully. But that's seen, time and time again through the court system. But in terms of a character like Roger Rogerson, I would hope to think that, there's no more Roger Rogersons that would be able to flourish in an organisation such as the police in these days. But having said that, what I've seen in the last couple of years in relation to, what's happened to the crackdown on human rights of people in relation to COVID and whatnot, certainly my view of policing and what I joined it for and what it's turned out to be in many respects, which is basically just an arm of the government now, has certainly been shattered. So I think there certainly is the potential for abuse of power to happen now in organisations such as the police. And I believe that, COVID's been a classic example where people's civil liberties have been taken away, and the police have acted excessively on a number of occasions in relation to their response to that particular issue. So I certainly think that there is that. It's something that's always a reality that you could get rogue police in any organisation, but I would hope to think that character and infamy of killing people, that we don't see the likes of people like him again.
Yeah, absolutely. Harry, how did you react to the death of Rogerson? Was it kind of a good riddance, or was there a feeling that it was just another person, of which maybe many?
Yeah, look, I didn't really react at all, to tell you the truth. It's just, we're only on this earth for a short time, so eventually we're all going to pass on. But what Steve was saying, I think we've got a problem in our in all our bureaucracies and the police force as well. The people that are being recruited now have been, through whatever means, have been socially engineered, they're not taught the Constitution. I don't know. They go to college and they learn the law, whatever they do, but, and they're young and whatever, and we saw what happened over the last 4 years. So I think, and maybe what's happening is, there's a real problem at the moment. Police in all states and in the Commonwealth and the Commonwealth can't, having trouble recruiting staff because of, what's transpired. Because, and I think maybe they're recruiting and getting the wrong, they're just getting the wrong type of person, whether it's by coincidence or by accident, or it's been done deliberately. Maybe they want people that will follow orders and they're smart enough to do the job, but not too smart to ask too many questions. And I think that's what we saw the last 4 years, because, the police values human rights, civil liberties were just thrown. They weren't even following the Biosecurity Act 2015. They weren't even following the legislation. Okay, let alone the Constitution. So I think that's what's happening now. We're just, like I said again, we're seeing the end result of generations and generations of people that have come through systems. And now we're seeing that people, you know, aren't as willing or not as competent, or they're not as knowledgeable as they should be. And we saw a lot of good police that were forced to leave because they could see what was happening. They were being forced to do something that was unlawful and unconstitutional, and they had no other choice. And a lot of them did stay, but took it, and some have suffered consequences, some haven't health-wise, but that's where we're at. And I think it's, unfortunately, the problem's a lot bigger. And I think it's in all sectors of society, it's quite big, and we can see it. It's just manifesting, and that's what we're seeing now. And there's no one easy fix. But if we go back to basic values, go back to teaching our children core values and teaching them, how to learn, read, write, and not whether they want to be a boy or a girl, and with all this sort of nonsense, this sort of stuff, they can't do, they're an adult at 18 and they can make up. When you're 18, you can do whatever you want. And the basic underlying principle is do no harm. So as long as you do no harm, you can do whatever you want. But when you're 18, that's the legal age, but, leave the kids alone. But that's what's happening. I think a lot of that's what we're seeing now. People coming into the workforce that have come through that system are either confused or whatever, and that's the results we're seeing, I think. So it's not just one. It's not a very simple fix. It's quite deep, and it needs needs the boat being turned around 180 and going back to where we were, back to basic core values.
So not necessarily more power for police, but better cops rather than more power and understanding.
I think they should. Well, the last 4 years, I think my personal opinion is they all need to be retrained and understand the constitution and the laws and their values. Because even Mick Fuller said we're going to treat COVID as a criminal, and they pretty much threw the book out.
Yep, and there it is.
That's what we saw.
I want to thank you, Harry Hatzikalymnios and Steve Kelly, for taking the time today to share views on a very, very sad situation that we saw in Sydney. Yeah. And let's hope that this doesn't happen again. Certainly 2 in 3 days is unheard of in this once peaceful city and country. So thanks, Steve. Thanks, Harry. Really appreciate your time and wish you all the best in your endeavours. We're going to take a break and be back with more. You don't want to go anywhere. This is the best place to be when you're watching and listening to Weekends with Jason Olborn here on TNT.